This week, Google tells its users they should have no expectation of privacy using their products. Record industry could be liable for $6 billion in withheld payments to musicians. And woman sent to jail for accidentally filming 3 minutes of a movie. This is Pirate Party Radio, Episode 7 for Thursday, December 10th, 2009.
People are treating Google like their most trusted friend. Should they be?
Well, I think judgment matters.
Eric Schmidt is Google's CEO.
If you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. But if you really need that kind of privacy, the reality is that search engines, including Google, do retain this information for some time. And it's important, for example, that we are all subject in the United States to the Patriot Act. It is possible that that information could be made available to the authorities.
2 years ago, Matt surfed for porn, downloading dozens of files, discovering some contained images of children. Matt claims he quickly deleted the files. About a year later, FBI agents showed up. The family let agents examine the computer. At first, they found nothing. Then, deleted images were found deep on the hard drive.
I asked him, where are you getting that stuff from? I don't even remember that. And, I asked him, could I even access that if I wanted to? And they said no.
Now, 22 years old and facing 20 years in prison.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last control points. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, your source for news on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture, and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show, and you can check out our webpage at piratepartyradio.com. Those intro samples were taken from stories today that I'm going to talk about Google, and also a man who's facing prison for 20 years for files he accidentally downloaded and subsequently deleted, but they dug them up. They were able to find them. We're going to get right into the news today because I've got a whole bunch of news. Pirate Bay founders granted appeal against operating ban. This is sent in by DC and it's from torrentfreak.com. In October, the Stockholm District Court banned two of the Pirate Bay's founders from operating the site. If they continue to work on the Pirate Bay, both will have to pay fines of $71,000. The two founders immediately decided to challenge the verdict, and the appeal court has now announced that it will grant the appeal. The Pirate Bay and its founders have been on a legal roller coaster ride this year. Directly or indirectly, they have been involved in a dozen court cases, most notably the trial in which four people associated with the site were sentenced to 1 year in jail and hefty fines. Despite this unfavorable verdict, the site remains online as it adapts to become a torrent portable that is less likely to be shut down. In yet another attempt to close the site, two of the site's founders were ordered by the Stockholm District Court to stop operating the site in October, facing fines of $71,000 each if they chose not to comply. The two founders, Gottfried Svartholm and Frederick Nietzsche, both decided to appeal the verdict, and the appeal court has now announced that it will take on the case. Gottfried argued that the district court lacks the technical skills that are required, which is devastating to a case which is so technically complicated. Frederick further said that both he and Gottfried have been living outside Sweden for a long time, adding that the Pirate Bay is no longer hosted in Sweden either. Aside from the technical difficulties, the legal authorities may also find that it's pretty much impossible to prove that the two are actually working on the site, which is required to impose the fines. The appeal court will review these and other issues in the upcoming appeal. The New Moon Director defends a woman accused of piracy. You may have read in the news earlier this week that a woman was taken to jail for 2 days for taping accidentally 3 minutes of the Twilight Saga. This was sent in by a whole bunch of people, including Malkav. I think he was the first on the draw. This is from suntimes.com. A Chicago woman facing prison time for videotaping 3 minutes of the Twilight Saga New Moon has a new ally in her legal battle, the film's director. Veteran director Chris Wright told the Sun-Times he's dismayed about Samantha Tumpak's arrest November 28th at a Rosemont movie theater on a felony charge of illegally copying his new hit film, and he's contacted the film studio about his concerns. Needless to say, the case seems to me terribly unfair, and I would like to do what I can to address this, Wright wrote in an email. The 22-year-old Tumpak could receive a 3-year prison term. So that's 1 year for every minute that she accidentally taped. After being arrested on a rarely used felony charge intended to prevent movie patrons from secretly recording new movies with handheld cameras, then selling bootleg copies. Tumpak, who spent 2 days in jail awaiting a bond hearing after her arrest, acknowledged there were a couple of short segments of the movie on her digital camera, though she contended she wasn't trying to record the movie. Instead, Tumpak told Sun-Times last week that she was taping parts of her sister's surprise 29th birthday party celebrated at Movico Theater, including her and other family members singing Happy Birthday. Well, she shouldn't have admitted that, because now the RIAA can go after her for not paying royalty fees for singing Happy Birthday in a public place, but I digress. The 3 minutes of footage she shot inside the theater, Tumpak said, also included film previews and ads, along with short segments of the film and her talking about the camera and the movie. It was never my intention to record the movie, Tumpak said. You can hear me talking the whole time. White's question whether her arrest was justified. There is, needless to say, a difference between trying to protect the copyright of a film and making an unfair example of somebody who is clearly not seems to not have any intentions towards video piracy, White wrote. He said that he had contacted the studio that released the film, Summit Entertainment, to express his concern about her arrest, but he acknowledged there's probably little he can do to influence the outcome of her case. I'm not sure what effect I can have on the case, he wrote, noting the film is, after all, not my property. Tumpak, who faced a court date of December 17th, couldn't be reached for comment. She said last week she considered the incident a big thing over nothing. We were just messing around, she said. Everyone is surprised it got this far. Well, what happened is that she was in the theater. She had a new camera that she just got recently, and she brought it to the birthday party so she could film, you know, portions of the birthday party happening and this surprise. And they sung Happy Birthday, you know, normal things that you would do at a birthday party, record things. You can watch them later. But this happened to be at a movie theater, and, you know, the previews were going on, and she was talking about her camera. And rather than go up to her, the movie house did not even talk to her about this. What they did is they phoned the police immediately about her. They phoned the police. The police came in and arrested her. They didn't tell her to put down the camera. Not the police, but the movie theater didn't come up to her and say, put down the camera, you're not allowed to record stuff. What they did immediately was phone the police. A bit of an overreaction, which could all be quelled by just going up to her and asking her, what are you doing? You know you're not supposed to film. You're not supposed to have cameras in here. Could you put down the camera and stop filming? Because she only filmed 3 minutes of it, and that was including some previews. So this call all could have been blown over, but maybe the film companies have told the theaters to immediately call the police whenever that something like that happens, because they're looking for somebody to make an example of. And this is probably the wrong person to make an example of, since it's such a mild, mild, mild case. Next story. Record industry faces liability over infringement. This was sent in by David G. This is from thestar.com. Chet Baker was a leading jazz musician in the 1950s, playing trumpet and providing vocals. Baker died in 1988. Yet he is about to add a new claim to fame as the lead plaintiff in possibly the largest copyright infringement case in Canadian history. His estate, which still owes the copyright and owns the copyright in more than 50 of his work, is a massive class action lawsuit that has been underway for the past year. The infringer has effectively already admitted owing at least $50 million, and the full claim could exceed $6 billion. If the dollars don't shock, the target of the new lawsuit undoubtedly will. The defendants in the case are Warner Music Canada, Sony BMG Music Canada, EMI Music Canada, and Universal Music Canada, the four primary members of the Canadian Recording Industry Association. The CRIA members were hit with the lawsuit October 2008 after artists decided to turn to the courts following decades of frustration with the rampant infringement. The claims arise from a long-standing practice of the Recording Industry of Canada, described in the lawsuit as exploit now, pay later, if at all. This is written by Michael Geist, by the way. It involves the use of works that are often included in compilation CDs, for example, the top dance tracks of 2009 or live recordings. The record labels create, press, distribute, and sell the CDs, but do not obtain the necessary copyright licenses. Instead, the names of the songs on the CD are placed on a pending list, which signifies that approval and payment is pending. The pending list dates back to the late 1980s, when Canada changed its copyright law by replacing a compulsory license with the need for a specific authorization for each use. It is perhaps better categorized as a copyright infringement admission list. However, since for each use of the work, the record label openly admits that it has not obtained copyright permission and not paid any royalty or fee. Over the years, the size of the pending list has grown dramatically, now containing more than 300,000 songs. From Beyoncé to Bruce Springsteen, the artists waiting for payment are far from obscure. And as thousands of Canadian and foreign artists have seen their copyrights used without permission and payment, it is difficult to understand why the industry has been so reluctant to pay its bills. Some works may be in the public domain or belong to a copyright owner difficult to ascertain or locate. Yet the likes of Sarah McLachlan, Bruce Coburn, Sloan, or The Watchmen are not hidden from view. The more likely reason is that the record labels have little motivation to pay up. As the balance has grown, David Baskin, the president and CEO of Canadian Music Reproduction Rights Agency, notes that his affidavit, the record labels have devoted insufficient resources for identifying and paying the owners of musical works on the pending list. The CRIA members now face the prospect of a far greater liability. The class action seeks the option of statutory damages for each infringement. At $20,000 per infringement, potential liability exceeds $6 billion. These numbers may sound outrageous, yet they're based on the same rules that led the recording industry to claim a single file sharer is liable for millions in damages. After years of claiming Canadian consumers disrespect copyright, the irony of having the recording industry face a massive lawsuit will not be lost on anyone, least of all the artists still wanting to be paid, waiting to be paid. And I'm sure they want it as well. Indeed, they are also seeking punitive damages, arguing the conduct of the defendant record companies is aggravated by their strict and unremitting approach to their enforcement of their copyright industry interests against consumers. Now, this is exactly what the record industries are going after consumers for. The exact same thing. Using songs for their own personal use. Actually, this is worse. Scratch that. This is worse. The record companies are making money off of these things. They are making money off of unpaid debts to artists, which they actively claim and outright say they're not paying. And they're in turn pressing CDs and selling them to the public. And yet, on the other hand, they're going after people on the street, consumers, who are doing the exact same thing, but using it for personal use and no monetary gain. And now they're claiming that they're losing money, yet they're not paying their own artists. Irony. Irony doesn't even cover this. This is more than irony. Need to invent a new word. This next story sent in by Malcav. Fake fingerprint. Chinese woman fools Japan controls. He said, you mentioned in episode 6 about having to be fingerprinted to enter Japan, and it looks like someone found a way around it. This is from bbc.co.uk. A Chinese woman managed to enter Japan illegally by having plastic surgery to alter her fingerprints, thus fooling immigration controls, police claim. Lin Rong, 27, has previously been deported from Japan for overstaying her visa. She was only discovered when she was arrested on separate charges. Tokyo police said she had paid $15,000 to have the surgery in China. It is Japan's first case of alleged biometric fraud, but police believe the practice may be widespread. Japanese police suspect Chinese brokers of taking huge sums of money to modify fingerprints surgically. Local media reports that Miss Lin had undergone surgery to swap the fingerprints from her right and left hands. Skin patches on her thumbs and index finger were removed, then regrafted onto the matching digits of the opposite hand. Ow. Japanese newspapers said police have noticed that Miss Lin's fingers have unnatural scars when she was arrested last month for allegedly faking a marriage to a Japanese man. The apparent ability of illegal migration networks to break through the high-tech controls suggests that other countries whose fingerprint visitors could be equally vulnerable, not at least the United States, according to BBC Asia analyst Andre Vornik. So now that they've imposed these rules, they're having to deal with Gattaca-type deceptions against them. If anybody hasn't seen the movie Gattaca that is listening to this broadcast, immediately watch it. This is the exact same things that happened in the movie that he had to work around to be able to live in the society that Gattaca presents to the viewers. He had to fake his blood, fake his fingerprints, fake his DNA to get even a decent job because of these controls put in place to restrict movement within countries and restrict job access. And this is just the first step in the long string of what's going to happen with biometric security and the data that people are collecting with the biometrics that are used for immigration and whatever else, applying for jobs so that they can reference anything that has gone on in your past, even medical records. So this is a very telling story of the future. This next story, P2P pirate told, pay up and trash your files. And this was sent in by Sean Kay. This is from the New Zealand Herald.co.nz. A graduate student, and this is, I'm not going to talk about this for the things that you think I'm going to talk about them for. A graduate student who must pay 4 record labels a combined $675,000 in damages for downloading and sharing songs online has been ordered to destroy his illegal music files. But a judge declined to force him to stop promoting the activity that got him in trouble. Joel Tenenbaum, a Boston University student from Providence, Rhode Island, was ordered to refrain from future copyright violations and to destroy copies of recordings he downloaded without authorization. Very commonplace. It has happened over and over again, regardless of how ethical it is or not. It does happen. Record companies wanted U.S. District Judge. Now, this is the part. Listen to this. Record companies wanted U.S. District Judge Nancy Gertner to go further. They claim Tenenbaum has been encouraging people to visit a Swedish website, which is no longer Swedish, where they can illegally download songs he was sued for sharing. They didn't name the site because, you know, the newspaper doesn't want to get in trouble with the record companies as well. They went to the judge and told him to stop talking about it. This is a new step that the RIAA is trying to go forth with. They're trying to limit free speech about file sharing. Tenenbaum said he had nothing to do with the website, and Gertner said she would not attempt to silence Tenenbaum's criticism of the recording industry and copyright laws. Tenenbaum said he was pleased. She said, "Look, this isn't your business. He can say whatever he wants about the issue. He has First Amendment rights." Obviously, this is from the U.S. Tenenbaum said, Kara Duckworth, a spokeswoman for the Recording Industry Association of America, said the group was satisfied that the judge required Tenenbaum to destroy all illegal music files and refrain from further theft of our music. In July, a federal jury in Boston ordered Tenenbaum to pay $675,000 to four record labels for downloading and distributing 30 songs. So I'm going to whip up the calculator here. $675,000 divided by 30. Yeah, $22,000 a song. So it works out that in that previous story I was talking about. Tenenbaum's attorney, Harvard Law School professor Charles Nisson, said that he plans to file a motion for a new trial by January 4th. In a separate memorandum released yesterday, Gertner described her reasons for rejecting Tenenbaum's fair use defense before the case went to trial in jury July. Fair use is a legal doctrine that recognizes that the monopoly rights protected by copyright laws are not absolute. The doctrine holds that when somebody uses a creative work in a way that does not hurt the market for the original work and advances a public purpose, such as education or scholarship, it may be considered fair and not infringing. Gertner said Tenenbaum acknowledged that the purpose of his song sharing was so that his friends could enjoy the music. That is, the very use for which the artist or copyright holder is entitled to expect payment as a reward. So that's very common. But keep your eye out for the RIAA now trying to silence people talking about file sharing in itself, the act of it, and even mentioning sites that are allow peer-to-peer file sharing. This is a new tactic, so watch out for this. This next one's sent in by DC. The SkyTrain buskers face billing by TransLink for song royalties. It's from the VancouverSun.com. For the first 2 years in Angie Inglis' life in Vancouver, music proved to be more than just food for her soul. It puts food on her table and a roof over her head. 8 hours a day, 6 days a week as a busker earned Inglis on average just a little over $600. I was able to pay my rent, but just barely, she said. More importantly, the experience allowed her to connect with her urban home. The Manitoba transplant arrived in 2000, soon establishing herself as a favorite with local transit users, who dubbed her the SkyTrain songstress. That's why Inglis was so upset to hear about the recent threat to busker lifestyle in Vancouver. Musicians and singers who are approved to perform inside the region's SkyTrain stations were sent a letter in October from the region's transit authority informing that they soon could be asked to pay as much as $1,500 annually for a performance license. The letter states that SOCAN, the Society of Composers, Authors, and Music Publishers of Canada, is demanding royalties for songs being performed in stations. According to TransLink, these costs could add up to $40,000 a year and would be passed on to the artists. TransLink charges musicians $75 a year, a fee that doesn't cover the program's administration costs, said TransLink spokesman Ken Hardy. With the additional pressure, we're probably faced with the possibility of having to cancel the program. Marie-Josée Dupree, SOCAN's director of business development, said SOCAN's intent is not to penalize street musicians, but rather to ensure that businesses that allow musical performance on their premises obey the law. Under the Canadian Copyright Act, those authorizing performers to play any works covered under SOCAN's repertoire must purchase a license. Fees are set at $32.55 a day. Each day the music is performed, up to a maximum fee of $222.93 in any 3-month period. This is the next part. SOCAN's repertoire currently covers more than 3 million compositions worldwide, and according to Dupree, there's a presumption under the Act that a work is under copyright until proven otherwise. She says no particular fee has yet been discussed with TransLink. A transit busking program in Toronto underwent a similar review with SOCAN about 5 years ago, said Danny Nicholson of Toronto Transit Commission. Those discussions resulted in the TTC paying SOCAN about $23,000 annually to cover the copyright licensing issue. The majority of that cost has been absorbed by the commission, with the artists charging nearly yearly $150 fee. Each year, 75 acts are approved to play in its 25 of Toronto's subway stations. Two Juno Award winners are amongst the current licensees, including Roger Ellis, formerly of the Toronto rock band Edward Bear, and guitarist Adam Solomon of African Guitar Summit. So, here again is the presumption of being guilty before innocence. SoCan's assuming that she's singing other people's music and automatically has to pay a fee. They don't even consider that she'd be playing her own music, even with these Juno Award winners who've won awards for their music, their original music, have to pay this fee to put it back in their own pockets later at a much reduced amount because they're playing their own music. Now, I've heard this even in the past where retail outlets have been fined for not paying their fees, even though they're playing their friends' bands on CD that their friends have given to them of original music. Then they've never signed up to any of these major music licensees like SoCan or the other ones in the U.S. So there seems to be a crackdown on creative cultural freedoms by the corporations by assuming guilt that you're going to be playing other people's music and you need to pay for it. How can this be determined that you're going to be playing somebody else's music that is covered under the license? Automatically, they assume. There's not even a submission where you can say, I have played this person's music and you should automatically charge me for that amount. No, it's an automatic fee. No matter what music you're playing, SoCan assumes you're playing the music that you need to pay for, and you have to prove otherwise. You have to prove yourself innocent of this and pay them the fee. Shameful. This was sent in by Sean Kay. Google chief, only miscreants worry about net privacy. Theregister.co.uk, this was off of, if you're concerned about Google retaining your personal data, then you must be doing something you shouldn't be doing. At least that's the word from Google CEO Eric Schmidt. If you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place, Schmidt tells CNBC, sparking howls of incredulity from the likes of Gawker. But the bigger news may be that Schmidt has actually admitted that there are cases where the search giants are forced to release your personal data. If you really need that kind of privacy, the reality is that search engines, including Google, do retain this information for some time, and it's important, for example, that we are all subject in the United States to the Patriot Act, and it is possible that all that information could be made available to the authorities. There's also the possibility of subpoenas and hacks, but if any of this bothers you, you should be ashamed of yourself, according to Eric Schmidt. Gawker highlights the irony of Schmidt's typical haughty proclamations. After all, this is the man who banned CNET for a year after the news published information about him that it had gleaned from, yes, Google. But the larger point here is that Schmidt isn't even addressing the issue at hand. Per usual, when the privacy question appears, Google likes to talk about the people asking the questions. But the problem lies elsewhere, with the millions upon millions blissfully unaware of the questions. If you're concerned about your online privacy, you could always put the kibosh on Google's tracking cookies. You can avoid signing into Google accounts, and yes, you can avoid using Google for anything Eric Schmidt thinks you shouldn't be doing. But most web users don't even realize Google is hoarding their data. CNBC asks Schmidt, people are treating Google like their most trusted friend. Should they be? But he answers by scoffing at those who don't trust Google at all. Not that you'd expect anything less. As always, Schmidt's holier-than-thou attitude is wonderfully amusing, except that it's not. So, like I've been saying over and over again, don't trust any corporation that is retaining your data, because even the Google CEO is admitting that it's not private. You should have no expectation of privacy using their services. And if you are expecting some privacy, maybe you shouldn't be doing what you're doing online because it's bad anyway. So don't do it. Don't do things that you might get embarrassed for later. That's not the right approach to take. And if you'd like a good essay on the fallacy of this statement, that Schmidt's implying that if you've done nothing wrong, you have nothing to fear, is something titled I've Got Nothing to Hide and Other Misunderstandings of Privacy by Daniel J. Solov, who's a professor of law at George Washington University Law School. And I've linked to that essay in the Pirate Party forums if you want to go take a read on that. Spanish anti-piracy measure under fire, sent in by DC. This is from NewYorkTimes.com. The government of Spain has proposed new measures to curb the digital piracy of music and movies, but the bill has upset people on both sides of the debate over file sharing, with copyright owners calling it insufficient and internet companies denouncing it as heavy-handed. The proposal, detailed this week, calls for the creation of a government-sponsored commission with the power to investigate and shut down websites accused of being conduit for piracy. The bill stops short of a law recently approved in France, under which individuals who illegally downloaded copyright material could lose their internet connection. In Spain, music companies and other copyright owners want the government to enact similar law. We do not think that just going against the websites can be effective, said Fabrice Benoit, managing director of Universal Music Spain. Internet service providers have also withheld support for the government's proposal. Meanwhile, bloggers and representatives of web-based business met with Culture Minister Angles González Sinde on Thursday to protest the plan, even though, unlike France, the Spanish proposal could not result in anyone being disconnected from the internet. The internet should be free and not have any interference from groups that seek to perpetrate obsolete business models and stop the free flow of human knowledge. Opponents of the bill said in a manifesto distributed on the web. This week, music industry groups presented a petition signed by more than 2,500 musicians calling for stronger action against illegal copying, which is not a criminal offense in Spain. So this is something that I'm sure the Spanish Pirate Party needs to be aware of and are aware of, about how the clampdown on file sharing is going on around the world and how they're just copying each other's plans for the three strikes law. Now, this next story, I'm asking out there if anybody has encountered this before. Now, this is very, very interesting, and I've never heard of this. Time Warner hijacked my browser because of piracy. This is from Gizmodo.com. Time Warner, perhaps hip to the fact that I haven't bothered to check my MeetSpace snail mailbox in the last 3 weeks, took matters into their own hands and inserted this warning directly into my browser. At this point, file-sharing warners via snail mail and email are pretty commonplace. But this is the first time I've heard of an ISP taking the matter straight to the browser. At first I was worried, and then I was a bit annoyed. But I have to say, I give them credit for giving me the benefit of the doubt here. The purpose of this email, it starts. And by email, they mean electronic message they forced onto my screen. It goes on, is to remind you that the distribution of copyrighted material in this fashion may violate both copyright laws and Roadrunner's terms of service, and to tell you a bit about peer-to-peer programs, the dangers they can pose to your computer and our network, and the steps you can take to protect yourself. And it goes on from there. Considering all the horror stories you hear, this is a pretty reasonable intervention. All I had to do was click, I am aware of this issue and will take steps to resolve it. And I was on my merry way. Whether those steps should be deleting all the copyrighted material off my computer, removing my peer-to-peer software, getting my shit together and using a private tracker, or just trying a little bit harder to resist the urge to download Nick Cage's entire filmography on Mininova, they don't say. But as Roadrunner didn't treat me like a criminal, I respect them by not being one, or at least being a sneakier one. For some people, one copyright violation notice from their ISP is enough to scare them straight forever. Others wear their warnings like a badge of honor. What are your experiences with ISPs and copyright infringements? The writer asks. Now, I'm not so sure that he should have clicked that button that said, I am aware of this issue and will take steps to resolve it. As it sounds like a bit of admission of guilt, saying I'm aware of this issue that copyright infringement files that have gone through my system. And it, I think it possibly could be used against him in a court of law through the ISP saying, yes, we sent this to him. He clicked, I agree that I'm a copyright violator, and they can bring it up in a court case. Or this could just be the first step to a court case, and they're collecting it behind the scenes for a massive lawsuit. And this is the first time I've ever heard of this, where an ISP is making you agree to being a copyright violator. Now, this kind of thing in other countries like the UK, where they're proposing a three strikes law, this could be your first strike. And the second and third time, you're off the internet. And he doesn't mention whether there was another option to click to remove the browser hijacking that took place, like I don't agree, or just ignore it, because I'm guessing that if you don't click I agree, you're not going to be able to use the internet anymore. So they're kind of forcing you into an admission. At that point, you know what? I would be looking for another ISP, because there's no way that I'm going to click I admit that I've done this to my ISP, who has no power or say over what I do on the internet. Now, has anybody else encountered this kind of strong-handed tactics that are going on that this person has talked about? I'd like to hear about that. This next story, U.S. to Canada. Fix copyright and all your trade problems will go away. Magically. Added the magic line. Sent in by DC, and this is from ZeroPay.com. It's not a new idea floating around in the Canadian-US trade realm, but it is a noteworthy way the United States entertainment lobby pressures Canada on copyright-related issues. The idea for the copyright lobby to say, you change copyright laws and we relax the Buy American provision sounds good on paper, but it doesn't take into account other big moments that happened on the copyright file in Canada. It doesn't matter how wrong the U.S. may be about Buy American and countless other trade irritations, Howard Knopf said, describing the situation at hand. He continues, or even if the U.S. is the most flagrant scofflaw at the WTO in international copyright law. He adds how Canada actually may have have better provisions in its copyright law, and has several other thoughts on why Mary Scott Greenwood's comments are astonishing, which is definitely worth the read. It's easy to see from the American copyright law's perspective that this would be the most effective way on getting their copyright laws in place in Canada. You take one trade issue that is hugely controversial and say that if you fix this issue of copyright, which barely registers as a blip on the political radar screen by comparison, then this big problem of Buy American would go away. An attempt at appearing to offer more and asking for less on the surface. The problem that it's hard to see to this as being conditional. What's to say if Canada fixes, which to many who are aware of the copyright issue really means breaks, copyright law, and the U.S. turns around and says, good start, we demand this and this and this before we'll consider relaxing the Buy American provision. Furthermore, how much is this current government party of Canada, the Conservatives, willing to risk over bending backwards for the copyright lobby in the first place? Simply appeasing the U.S. lobby over copyright has already cost one minister her job back when Bill C-60 was a much-despised copyright legislation. When protesters swarmed another minister over the new copyright legislation, Bill C-61, it should have been clear that merely appeasing the U.S. copyright lobby means losing votes. The Conservative did seem to get that message when it created the copyright consultation over the summer. The last thing the party might want to do is to admit that the whole consultation was a farce and just for show, and it would further inflame the tensions on copyright file. Added to this was the dramatic news of CRIA, an organization that mainly represents four foreign-owned record labels, was sued for $6 billion for, of all things, music bootlegging, agreeing to whatever the copyright laws that the U.S. entertainment lobby would mean giving carte blanche to these same entities over who sets the standards on the copyright file. A thought that would sit well with few Canadians at this point. So while the U.S. copyright lobby might be pulling their hair out over Canada's copyright laws, there isn't much they can really do about it immediately, and the issues will simply continue to be pushed down the road for a later time, unless a party willing to lose an election over copyright, that is. So there's some heavy-handed tactics going on from the U.S. entertainment industry towards Canada, saying, oh, we'll make these other problems go away if you just tighten your copyright restrictions. Now, that's a little bit underhanded and even blackmail-ish on the surface, it seems, that they're trading this for that, and seems a bit fishy, and you can't really write that kind of stuff down on paper to guarantee it, like the person who's writing the article says. Boy broadcaster riles regulators. A 14-year-old Gloucester boy who embodies the spirit of rock and roll has been warned by the Industry Canada to shut down his pirate radio station or face charges and a hefty fine. This is from OttawaCitizen.com. Jahid Sadeh says Wednesday night he has been operating Mix FM, a 91.9 on the FM frequency, for the last week or so and wants it to stay on the air. Problem is, his station does not have the required CRTC broadcasting license and Industry Canada broadcasting certificate. On Tuesday, Industry Canada officials warned Jahid and his father, George Said, that the broadcasts were illegal. The operator voluntarily complied with Industry Canada's request to cease operation and pursue the required authorities in order to comply with the laws governing broadcasting in Canada, spokeswoman Stephanie Power wrote in an email to The Citizen. But last evening, Jahid was still spinning tunes and taking calls from listeners who likes his request line and top 40 dance mix. I like doing it because it's the only radio station that plays every request and lets everyone talk in the air, he says. My friends really like it. George Said said he doesn't understand why the bureaucracy wants to shut down his son's station. He's only a kid. He's smart. They should be encouraging him to do this. He plays beautiful music. Jahid has been fascinated by radio broadcasting since he was a small child playing with a toy walkie-talkie set, his father said. Jahid said the station is on the air 24 hours a day, although he is only behind the microphone after school and on weekends. This is my hobby. I have all professional equipment. The computer does the work for me when I'm not here. But I'm here almost every day, and if I can, I'll be here. The station's transmitter is a setup on the roof of his father's hotel and restaurant on Bank Street, north of Greeley. His radio studio occupies part of the same building. Jahid will soon have to sign off the air permanently or face serious consequences. If the unauthorized broadcast radio station resumes operation without proper authority, Industry Canada could consider taking enforcement measures, Power said in the email. The penalties for contravening the relevant section of the Radio Communication Act includes a maximum fine of $5,000, a jail sentence of up to a year, or both. A fine of $250 per offense per day could also be imposed under the Act, but the baby-faced broadcaster is not giving up without a fight. I need big support to stay on the air, he said. Can you ask people to call me at the station? 613-822-9190. That's the station number, and I'm hoping people will get behind me. So this is a real pirate radio station that this kid is broadcasting. So he's got some big clankers going on there to stand up against the regulators of radio. And I would advise against going to his website because it's pretty hard on the eyes, but kind of interesting that he's doing this. But he is applying for a license that I did read in another story, but he's not shutting down the station in the meantime. So if you're in that area and you want to listen to it, I guess tune in and listen to the best top 40 dance mixes. This next story is absolutely frightening. This is the scariest story I've heard in a long time. Accidental download sending a man to prison. This is CBS13.com. A local man is likely to go to prison for years after he says he accidentally downloaded child pornography onto his computer. Now, this is referencing the sample I played at the top of the show. Matthew White, 22, said he was surfing for pornography 2 years ago on LimeWire, a file-sharing application that allows users to trade music, movies, games, and pictures, when he discovered that some of his files had downloaded were images of children. Matt claims he quickly erased the files. "It didn't appeal to me," he said. "I was looking for women my age, so I just wanted to download College Girls Gone Wild and accidentally downloaded underage pornography." About a year later, FBI agents showed up at his family's home. The family agreed to let agents examine the computer, and at first, they couldn't find anything. Investigators later were able to recover the deleted images from deep within the hard drive. I asked them, "Where did you get that? I don't remember that," I asked them. Could I access that if I wanted to, Matt said. They said no. Facing 20 years in prison for possessing child pornography, Matt is pleading guilty on the advice of his public defender in hopes of getting 3.5-year sentence. He will also serve 10 years probation and have to register as a sex offender for the rest of his life. Matt's father says other parents need to be warned about the consequences of stumbling across illicit material. One day, you're going to get a knock on the door and have your child taken away for many years. Matt's court date has been moved to January 8th due to paperwork issues, according to reports. The FBI could not comment on the specific case, but said if child pornography is ever downloaded accidentally, the user needs to call authorities immediately. They may confiscate your computer, but it's better than the alternative. Internet searches reveal a large number of complaints from people who said they've accidentally downloaded child pornography through LimeWire. Now, this is absolutely frightening, that if you could be searching through web pages and going to links that you find through Google, and even something as innocuous as a pop-up comes on your screen, and it even looks remotely illegal, because I know there's laws out there that can term underage pornography or child porn as somebody who even looks like a child. And that's what a lot of these sites go for, is people that look close to 18 as possible. So, looking as young as possible while still being of legal age. And even so, if you accidentally go down the clicking path of doom of pop-ups coming on your screen, you could accidentally get something on your screen that is illegal or termed illegal, even if it's not necessarily illegal. And these people are of age of 18 because they look 18, under 18. Now, this stuff you didn't actually download, but it's on your computer. It's a cached file on Firefox or Internet Explorer. Now, the average person doesn't know where these cached files are, but they stick there on your computer unless you go into these options of Firefox and Internet Explorer and clear your cache. And even then, it's still on your computer. Even if a file pointer isn't pointing to it, it can be recovered as data, as chunks of data, that if, as long as you haven't overwritten it with another piece of data, it's still on your computer. And if you're being investigated for anything else, even though it has nothing to do with this, and they find it, or if you take it in your computer for repair and they find it using an undelete program or something because you've accidentally deleted something and you need to get it back, like a work, something that you've done for your work or your job or school, and they undelete these things and they're required by law to report it to the FBI, all of a sudden, you're facing jail time of 20 years for something you didn't actively do. Now, this is extremely frightening. Now, the FBI is saying, turn yourself in if you ever find child pornography. Turn yourself in and we'll take away your computer. Now, that doesn't sound like a very great deal to me. Yeah, not the best of plans. Yeah, I'd like to give up my computer, please. So, this is a warning to people all out there that you really need to make sure that your deleted files are deleted, that they're gone, overwritten, that you can't be dug up, things can't be dug up, like things that are accidentally downloaded. Either they be MP3s or movies or things that are accidentally downloaded and cached in your on your computer. I mean, is the RIA going to go to these extents in the future where you could be streaming music over or streaming a trailer or streaming part of a movie onto your computer and it gets cached in your browser? And all of a sudden, this is shown to be that you've downloaded this music. And now that you have copyrighted music on your computer, you're going to be sent to jail. You're going to be fined for violating copyright infringement. It's a bit extreme. It's going a bit far. And showing that these cases that I'm talking about today are frightening. Absolutely frightening. And you need to be aware of these things so that you can protect yourself against these outrageous things that these the powers that be are doing. So be aware and protect yourself. Facebook's privacy changes draw more scrutiny. Now, recently, Facebook has changed their privacy policies. And now, is it for the better or for the worse? This is from NewYorkTimes.com. This is what they say. Since I wrote about Facebook's privacy changes on Wednesday, there's been more criticism of some of the changes. While Facebook has been given people more refined controls over who can see particular pieces of information they post, one controversial move is that several pieces of data are now visible to all members on the service. Your name, city, gender, photograph, and the profile pages you're a fan of, and your list of friends. Facebook says it has done this partially to make it easier for users to search the Morris of 350 million users, many with similar names. It points out that users could never restrict the visibility of their name, the networks they belong to, or the pages they were a fan of, and that gender was mostly always discernible from a user's name and photo. The changes we're announcing is equivalent to requiring a name to be in a phone book, completely out of order without a phone number, wrote Barry Schnitt, a Facebook spokesman, noting that there are other ways in privacy settings for people to avoid being found in search results by non-friends. But he noted, users come to Facebook to connect and share, not to hide. Still, privacy organizations and some users are critiquing the move, and a blog post the Electronic Frontier Foundation called this part of Facebook's privacy change downright ugly. Users are coming to share with whom they want to, which is not necessarily everyone on the internet, said Kevin Bankston, a senior staff lawyer at the group, noting that these privacy distinctions were what always differentiating Facebook from MySpace and the rest of the web. Now Facebook is clumsily trying to change the game and push users to share more than they ever have before. At least some users agree. One wrote to Bits yesterday objecting to the fact that his friends list was now visible to everyone. It's certainly a violation of my privacy policy. My own personal privacy policy specifically states that I will not share information about my friends with any potential weirdos, child molesters, homicidal maniacs, or anyone I generally don't like, he wrote. Facebook is also being criticized for recommending that users set privacy controls to share their status messages and other content with anyone on the internet. The company says that more than 20 million users have used its tool to review their privacy settings, and more than half have changed an option from the choice recommended by Facebook. In our minds, this is a clear evidence that privacy advocates are wrong, and the process is transparent and informative, Barry Schnitt, a Facebook spokesman. Our users are smarter and more attentive to privacy than privacy advocates are giving them credit for. I'm curious what our readers think about these changes. Those who are particularly upset with the quasi-public aspects of Facebook service can, of course, take advantage of one killer Facebook feature, not using it at all. And that pretty much sums it up. If you don't want your stuff on the internet by people that are proposing to keep your privacy secure, don't put it on there. As Google and now Facebook have said, your privacy is not private, even if we say it is private. So assume everything on the internet is not private. Encrypt everything. Now I'm going to end the show on a positive note, actually, with a story that is a win for the people in the UK. police U-turn on photographers and anti-terror laws. And this is from the independent.co.uk. Police forces across the country have been warned to stop using anti-terror laws to question and search innocent photographers after the Independent forced seniors officials and to admit that the controversial legislation is widely being misused. The strongly worded warning was circulated by the Association of Chief Police Officers last night in an email sent to chief constables of England and Wales 43 police forces. Officers were advised that Section 44 powers should not be used unnecessarily against photographers. The message says officers and community support officers are reminded that we should not be stopping and searching people for taking photos. Unnecessarily restricting photography, whether from the casual tourist or professional, is unacceptable. Chief Constable Andy Trotter, chairman of ACPO's Media Advisory Group, took the decision to end the warning after growing criticism of the police's treatment of photographers. Writing in today's Independent, he says, "Everyone has a right to take photographs and film in public places. Taking photographs is not normally the cause for suspicion, and there are no powers prohibiting the taking of photographs, film, or digital images in public place." He added, "We need to make sure that our officers and police community support officers are not unnecessarily targeting photographers just because they're going about their business. The last thing in the world we want to is give photographers a hard time or alienate the public. We need the public to help us. Photographers should be left alone to get on with what they're doing. If an officer is suspicious of them for some reason, they can just go up to them and have a chat with them. Use old-fashioned police skills, to be frank, rather than using these powers, which we don't want to overuse at all." Section 44 of the Terrorism Act allows the police to stop and search anyone they want without need for suspicion in a designated area. The exact location of these many of these areas are kept secret from the public, but are thought to include every railway station and well-known tourist landmarks thought to be at risk of terrorist attacks. Many photographers have complained that the officers are stopping them in mistaken belief that the legislation prohibits photographs in those areas. Forces have used Section 44, most commonly London's Metropolitan Police, have repeatedly briefed and guided frontline officers on how to use these powers without offending the public. But privately, senior officers are exasperated, depressed, and embarrassed by the action of junior officers, and particularly PCSOs who routinely misuse the legislation. One source said that an internal urban myth had built up about the police officers who believe that photography in Section 44 areas are not allowed. So this is great. All the photographers out there and filmographers are allowed to, again, once again, film famous landmarks. This is a bit ridiculous, thinking that people aren't going to be taking pictures of these large landmarks and train stations. That's where people take photos the most. So I can see why this is built up to this point. And it's kind of ridiculous that the police force would just be arbitrarily stopping every single person taking a photograph in a public place. And I didn't even know about this legislation where there's secret places where people can just be arrested for no reason. Secret places. You don't even know where these places are. If you stand on this side of the line, you can be arrested for no reason. But if you're on this side of the line, you're fine. You have to have a reason to be arrested. So has anybody in the UK ever been bugged by the police for just simply taking a photo? And for that matter of fact, anybody anywhere been bugged by the police for taking photos or film? Luckily, I live in Vancouver, where there's massive amounts of film going on all the time by movie industries. This is a major hub where movies are being filmed. So everybody's very used to things being filmed constantly. So I've never been bugged or approached by the police for filming. And I do tons of filming all the time and photograph taking. So luckily, I'm okay here. Now, on a similar related note to the UK, kind of, the closing song, which I'm not actually going to play because I haven't gotten permission to play it and it's a commercial song, is Integral by Pet Shop Boys. And this was released in 2006 to protest the national ID cards that are going into effect in the UK, which are right now voluntary for people in the UK, but could become mandatory. And for copyright reasons, obviously, I won't be playing the song, but some of the lyrics are, "Everyone has their own number in a system that we operate under. We're moving to a situation where your lives exist as information. One world, one life, one chance, one reason, all under one sky, unchanging, one season." And if you have news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions or comments, just head over to PiratePartyRadio.com and submit them through the form on the website. And I've linked in the Pirate Party Radio forums to the Pet Shop Boys song that you can hear on YouTube. And there's a whole bunch of remixes on there as well. So thank you for listening. And until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.